So this morning, I am going to do something a little different. We're actually going to be looking at a text from Isaiah this morning. We're looking at one of the central prophecies of the coming of the Christ. And so we're going to talk about that this morning. I do want to take a second to wish my wife a happy 25th anniversary. Ethel was at the wedding, said it would never last. Hey, and how long have you and Bob been married?
4 years.
How many?
64.
Gotta have to be 104 to get to, no, 94. I have to be, good luck. But we appreciate everybody's well wishes for our anniversary. Thank you very much. So, all right, so we're gonna be looking at this text this morning from Isaiah chapter 7, verses 14 and 15. Now, there's some backstory here, because this is, which is not uncommon in prophecy, there is a dual meaning to the passage. It addresses a particular issue that's going on in Israel at the time, and then also is a prophecy about the Christ. And so, just to set that up and let everybody understand kind of how this text works, going to do a little backstory here. So, this is during the reign of King Ahaz of Judah, and the king of Israel, Israel and Judah, by the way, were frequently at war, as brothers are wont to do. After the empire split, they fought quite a bit, and so at this time, the king of Israel, whose name was Pekah had signed an alliance with another nation, and they had come and besieged Jerusalem. And so Ahaz, who was an evil king, is currently the king of Judah, and God sends Isaiah to give him a prophecy. And so that's kind of where we pick up. You've got this backstory of difficulty as the city of Jerusalem is under siege. A significant part of Judah has already been defeated as this siege has kind of come into place. Now, it is interesting that a prophecy about the Messiah would come at such a difficult time. Now, we are kind of wired in, I guess maybe it's just kind of a byproduct of being Americans, but we are kind of wired into this belief that if God is pleased with you, good things will always happen to you, and that if God is displeased with you, bad things will happen to you. How many of you have ever felt that way? That, you know, I must be doing something, you know, things are not going well right now. I must be doing something wrong. And we kind of forget that Satan kind of plays into this as well. And so we sometimes kind of get separated from the reality that in Scripture, good people suffered all the time, right? Okay. If the concept that if good people do good things will happen to them, if that is true, then the Apostle Paul must not have been nearly as good a dude as we think. Because Paul got beat up in every city he went to. He got constantly thrown into jail. And by the way, he gives a record of all the stuff that happened to him. Shipwrecked, beaten with rods, stoned, whipped, imprisoned. I mean, this guy, nothing went right for this guy. The apostles were constantly being persecuted. The church was constantly being persecuted. So it is important to note that sometimes bad things happen because they happen. And it's not necessarily a punishment of the good. It's just the nature of things. And so it is that as this situation is occurring in Israel. And by the way, the king of Israel is every bit as evil as the king of Judah. So it's unlikely that God was picking sides, because they were both equally rotten people. But it is during this siege that Isaiah comes and he shares these words. Now, he's come to Ahaz and he's come to give him a prophecy that everything is going to be okay. And in the midst of this prophecy, Isaiah says, listen, why don't you, to prove that I'm speaking God's word, why don't you ask God for something? And then he can give it to you and prove that I'm speaking his word. And Ahaz says, no, I'm not going to test God. Now, it's unlikely he did this because he was a real proponent of God, because he was not. He was involved in idol worship. This is probably more his disdain for God than anything else. But Isaiah then says this to him in verse 14. He says, therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. Okay. Now, if this text is only a prophecy about the coming of the Messiah, anybody want to take a guess at how far away from this particular text Jesus was from coming? How many years until his birth? It would have been several hundred. This is probably in the ballpark, because Israel hasn't fallen yet. So probably between 700 and 800 years before the birth of Christ, Isaiah gives this prophecy. Now, how is this going to be a sign to the current king that something's going to happen in 800 years? And the answer is, it's probably not. And so there's very likely some double meaning here. In kind of looking at this, I found something really interesting. In the Old Testament, the word they use for virgin could be translated a number of ways. And one of the ways it was translated was a single woman who was sexually mature. So she was old enough to bear children, but she was single and still has not participated in marital relations. So because she's single, he says, this woman's a virgin who's going to be with child and bear a son. So the idea here is that probably at the time of this prophecy, there was a woman who had not gotten married yet. And in the time that she gets married and bears a child, in that time, and she's going to name him Emmanuel, you will know that this siege is going to end. So he is kind of laying a time frame. But this text has a double meaning, as this is also a prophecy of the birth of Jesus. Now, what's really interesting about this is that Isaiah would take the time through God's instruction to give a prophecy about the coming of a Messiah at a time of incredible distress. Now, I assume none of you have ever been under siege. Some of you probably feel like you've been under siege before. So let's kind of just so we understand kind of what the context here is, you've got this walled city and the city is under siege. Now, because the city is under siege, what problems immediately come about when your city is under siege? Supplies. Now, we all right now are experiencing supply chain issues in the United States, and we act like this is the worst thing ever. It's not as bad as you think. And I know that because the grocery store has an ample supply of Little Debbie Christmas tree cakes. And as long as you can get those, you can live. You can live on Little Debbie Christmas tree cakes. I feel confident. You will not live healthy. You won't live healthy, but you will live. There's also an ample supply of Christmas beverages that only come out at Christmas time, like cranberry Sprite, which I don't know why anybody would do that. Cranberry 7-Up, you know, it's like all the light colas, there's cranberry, and I don't know why cranberry is something you drink at Christmas, but apparently it is. But there's all, you know, you go to the stores, and there's, now it may not be everything you want, but there's stuff. But yet, with all the stuff that we have, what do we notice? The stuff that's not there, right? We all notice the stuff that's not there. So while under siege, guess what's there? Nothing. There's no food grown in the city. The farms are all outside the city wall. So because there's siege, there's no food. Now, if I was going to ask you this morning, what's the hungriest you've ever been? So, what's the longest you've ever gone without food? Now, some of you are going, what? I didn't ask why, Linda, I didn't ask why. I'm so glad the microphone didn't pick you up so everybody at home didn't hear that. I didn't ask. I never ask why. You guys are like my history students. You ask the question you wish I'd ask and not the question I did. I've gone 12 hours. I think maybe 24 hours I've gone without food before. It was the most miserable 24 hours of my life. If any of you have ever had to have minor surgery, they won't let you eat from like after midnight. And they scheduled me for like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm like, why can't I eat at breakfast then? Because if you get scheduled at 6 a.m., they won't let you eat after midnight. Well, that's 6 hours. They schedule you at 1, it's like 13. That's twice as long. Why can't I eat breakfast? And they just tell you, shut up. They don't care. So imagine when this kind of siege happens, as the food begins to run out, people start getting really hungry. And by the way, there are stories in the Old Testament about sieges that took place where people actually went to cannibalism. They got so hungry they would actually eat their dead, and in some cases, kill people to eat them. That's a very disturbing. Some of you are going, I thought this was a Christmas sermon. That doesn't sound Christmassy at all. So this is the kind of circumstance where Isaiah now chooses to give a prophecy about the Messiah. Why would you give a prophecy about the Messiah in such a time of suffering? Hope, but here's the thing. How many people who heard Isaiah say this had any idea that this was about the Messiah? This is for us. I mean, this is for those who would come later, who would read these words later. And the reason I think it's worth pointing that out is that we forget sometimes how smart God is and how he doesn't do anything that doesn't have a purpose or a reason. And a lot of times we don't get the reason. We don't understand the reason. It doesn't make sense to us, but that doesn't mean it has no purpose. And I would probably dare say that everybody in this room has been through some circumstance where they looked at God and went, I don't understand this. Why is this happening? This doesn't make any sense to me. And I would probably say a lot of us have said that about things that are happening in our society. We say it about things that have happened personally in our lives, and we're like, this doesn't make sense. I don't understand it. There's no reason for it. Why would God do this? Why would he allow this? But if there's one thing the scripture has taught us repeatedly, it's that when these kinds of things happen, God usually brings something out of it that may have nothing to do with us. It may have no direct impact on us. It may be for others. And so as Isaiah shares these words, the meaning of this is probably totally lost on Ahaz and anyone in that room that heard it. They don't see this as some sort of prophecy about the Messiah. And in fact, it's entirely possible that scribes and Pharisees for the next several hundred years, as they read the scrolls of Isaiah, would see that text and go, I don't know. I don't know what that's supposed to mean. Now think about this. If you believe the Messiah is coming, as the Jewish people did, what would you picture when he showed up? Now normally, if a God is going to show up, what form does he show up in? Is he a baby or is he full grown? Usually you expect a God to show up full grown. And if he's going to be a warrior king, he's going to show up. And you can kind of picture the Greeks or the Romans. I think the Greek god was Ares, the god of war. You know, the helm and the sword and the shield and the armor. And that's what you would expect. So if you're expecting Messiah, are you expecting a baby? So probably not. So this image of, behold, a virgin is going to be with child and bear a son, that's probably not something that most people would go, oh, okay, that's what that is. All right. In verse 15, he says, he will eat curds and honey at the time. He will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. Now I had to look some stuff up because this, when I read that, it didn't make any sense to me. So here's what the commentaries say about the curds and honey reference. Anybody know what a curd is? It's where milk has curdled a little bit and it kind of starts to become cheese. Is that Huh? Cottage cheese. Some of you like cottage cheese. I don't understand that, but hey, you do you. So he says he's going to eat. So if you're translating this into the modern language, he's going to eat cottage cheese and honey. Now, to some of you, that sounds really appealing. Now, here's what this really means. This actually means that he will exist in a time of desolation and misery. Now, I didn't understand that until I read this and they explain it. So the reason that he would be eating curds is that this would be an allusion to the fact that all of the farm animals would be dying, and that the farm animals who normally would nurse their young would be dead, and they would have an abundance of milk. And so there would be an abundance of milk for everybody, and because there would be so much milk that, again, without refrigeration, what happens when you have milk and you can't refrigerate it? It starts to curdle, it starts to turn into cottage cheese. So the idea here is that some terrible thing is going to happen to Israel where their flocks are going to be decimated, and there's going to be so much extra milk because of that. That's what you're going to eat. You're going to eat curds. And then the reference to honey. Why are you eating honey? Because the fields are desolate. And when the fields are desolate and no one's farming the fields, what grows in the fields? Flowers, wildflowers. And when you have an abundance of wildflowers in the field, what shows up in the field? Bees. And the bees make honey. Now, this is such an obscure reference. I was like, is that, that's really what that means. But that is, in fact, this was not an uncommon imagery in the Old Testament. So this idea that he will eat curds and honey is actually not a good thing. It's a bad thing. It means that the farmland will be desolate and that the farm animals will be dying in significant numbers. And it says all this is going to happen by the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. And Jewish custom puts that at about the age of 2. Now, that may sound like it's a little early for you, but remember, you're an adult in Judaism when you're 12. So they tended to be a little ahead on the clock. Now, I can say this. By the time my kids were 2, I expected them to know not to touch the television set. Right? I mean, those of you in here who are parents, you're like, 2? That seems awful early. But at 2 o'clock, at this point now, if the kids are throwing food at the table, you think they know better. And if they're going over and pushing buttons or trying to stick their finger in the electrical socket, you feel like they should know better by now, right? So this is not so unreasonable. So this verse in 15, he will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. So what this text is saying is that after this is going to happen, after this Emmanuel is born, there's going to be an incredible time of misery up until his second birthday, up until he's 2. Now, who can tell me what happened within 2 years of Jesus' birth in Judah? Herod has been told by the wise men that the Messiah has been born, a new king in Israel. And what does he do in response to that news? He goes to Bethlehem, and what does he do? He kills every male child under the age of 2. So you have this significant prophecy from Isaiah that not only will this child be born, but that he's going to be born in a time of desolation, and that great tragedy will exist in his life up until he is 2 years old. Now, in the time that this is actually said to Ahaz, this text means that after this child is born for 2 years, this siege is going to continue, and then eventually the alliance between Pekah and his allies will be broken and the siege will be lifted, but it's going to last for 2 years. And so he gives a time frame here. Now, what becomes really significant about this, and I don't, over the years I've not done a lot on prophecy at Christmas, because a lot of times it's kind of very hard to take that prophecy and go, okay, so here's the application. But this one I think has a very clear application for us, and I want to talk about that for a few minutes this morning. We are living in a time right now, and I've heard a lot of people say this over the last several months, that this just seems like a very dark time in our country. There's so much division, and there's so much anger and animosity, and there's so much political strife and social strife, and we blame it on all sorts of things, but the reality is it exists, and we're all aware of it. And it's just like, man, this is such a terrible time in our country, and we just seem to be mourning over that, and it seems to be a weight that just is pressing down on a lot of people, including the church. And we kind of look, we look to God and we say, why is this happening? Or maybe some of us are a little more inclined to say, we know why this is happening. We think we know. We think we have the answer. And so we spend all of our time focused on, I know why this is happening, or what can we do to stop this from happening? And we're busy telling God all this stuff. And you know what we're not doing? We're not listening. Because in times of difficulty, God frequently speaks to his people. And we're so busy mourning and being upset and fretting what's going on and complaining and being unhappy and wringing our hands. You know, I will freely admit I have been a part of this, but you know, all of you know I have lunch with a group of preachers on Tuesday, and one of the things we talk about is, you know, what is the post-COVID church going to look like? And there are a lot of guys worry about that. It's like, you know, is attendance ever going to come back up? I mean, have we just lost a segment of people that are forever going to stay at home and watch online? Or have we just lost a generation of people to the church? They've stopped coming. And you know how it is. You get out of the habit of something, and it's hard to get back into the habit. And so, you know, for a year and a half, I didn't go because of COVID, and now I'm just kind of out of the habit. And we worry about that. A lot of churches financially got hit hard during COVID. We wring our hands about that, and we wring our hands about attendance, and we wring our hands about this, and we wring our hands about the condition of the country and the supply chain issue and the social issues, and we're all upset. And at some point in that process, we probably should kind of stop and listen. Because throughout history, God has chosen to speak to his people in times of stress and turmoil. And a lot of times, people are so busy worrying about everything that they completely miss the message. I mean, think about it. As a church, we look back at the Pharisees and we go, how did they miss all the prophecies about Jesus? When all those prophecies were written, this prophecy and the prophecy in Isaiah 9 and the prophecy in Micah 5, and I only know those because I looked them up this morning. I don't have those memorized. I don't want you to think, oh, Stuart's just showing off. No, I looked all that stuff up this morning. And there's a bunch in Psalms, but there's too many Psalms for me to memorize where they were. But there's all these prophecies in the Old Testament that speak about Jesus. Micah says he's going to be born in Bethlehem. Isaiah says he's going to be born of a virgin. I mean, you've got all this information. How did the Pharisees miss it? And how did they miss that he wasn't going to be a warrior king? He wasn't coming to restore political Israel. How did they miss that? And the truth is, it's not that hard for us to understand, because we miss stuff all the time. When God tries to communicate to us, sometimes we're so obsessed with the answer that we want, we don't listen to the answer he's giving. I joke every semester with my students, and on the first test, it never fails. I'll give an essay question. And it never fails, as I'm grading that essay question, I will grade 5 or 6 where someone answered the question they wish I had asked and not the one I asked. And I'll even write on the test, I didn't ask this. I'll write it there. I did not ask this. And one student one semester actually wrote back to me, but that's what I knew. That's what I knew. That's why when I asked if you ever go without eating, Linda answered, here's why I didn't eat, which is not what I asked, but she, you know, that's what she, this is the answer. We understand this sometimes, and so we get obsessed with, we think we know the answer, and so what we do is instead of listening to what God is saying, we try to find that he is telling us what we want to hear. And we look for signs to prove that we're right. We do this a lot of times in Scripture. We make up our minds what the Bible says, and then we look for verses that prove that we're right instead of looking for verses that might suggest we're wrong. Any of you ever studied a verse and went, huh, I don't think that's right, because that's not what I believe. I've experienced that a lot in my life where I read a verse and go, huh, wow, I've never seen that before. That must be wrong. One of my favorite quotes is by Francis Chan. Francis Chan says, if you read a passage and the passage disagrees with what you believe, you're probably the one that's wrong. I love that quote. It's like, if you read a verse in the Bible and the Bible conflicts with what you think, you're probably the one that's not right. And so as we look at the circumstance that we're in right now, as we look at what's going on in our society, in our culture, in our country, politically, and we start looking, and we start trying to diagnose the problem, and we think we know all the answers, and we're trying to figure out all these things, what is God trying to communicate to us in this circumstance in which we exist? If you think about what the optimal time for the Messiah to be born would be, how many of you would say during the Roman occupation? That would be the best time for Jesus to come, during the Roman occupation. Most of us probably say that. That's a ridiculous time to send the Messiah. Why would you send the Messiah then? The reality is that God has a history of communicating and sending things at a time that we least expect it. And the question is, why aren't we expecting it? Why aren't we expecting it? If I ask you this morning, what do you expect God to do in the church in the next year? How would you answer that? Now, some of you would be pragmatic. And you would look at it and go, well, let's see, we're still in the middle of this coronavirus thing, and there seems to be new variants and new stuff, and a lot, my expectation would be pretty low. Because as long as the virus is there, attendance is going to be down, and we're going to be limited in what we can do and what kind of activities we can have. And it's like this year, we can't really go to the nursing homes and do Christmas caroling because the nursing homes are like, yeah, don't really want a big crowd of people coming in here. So we tend to fixate on everything that's wrong and everything that's not going to happen. If I told you this morning that God is going to do something really amazing in his church in the next year, would you believe me? Now, some of you would go, no, because you don't know either. And that would make me sad, but you'd be right. But the reality is that we have become so pessimistic in our outlook because of the world that we live in, we have no expectation for the church. We don't have any positive outlook. We don't have any positive expectation. We don't think great things are going to happen. You know why we don't think great things are going to happen? Because things aren't good. And we've forgotten who's in charge. We've forgotten who's in charge. I got news for you. God is bigger than social media. He is bigger than the multimedia corporations that seek to divide us. He's bigger than the coronavirus. He's bigger than social unrest. He's bigger than all of those things. He has the whole world in his hand. And we've forgotten that. Oh, we say it. I mean, we say it like we still believe it. But the reality is, we don't live like we believe it. We have become the most pessimistic people in the world. At a time when the whole world is pessimistic, who should be the most optimistic people out there? Should be us, right? Should be us. Why should it be us? Well, I'll tell you why it should be us. Because if you get the Rona and you die, guess where you go? You go to heaven. That's good news, right? If the world collapses, if there's some nuclear war, if everything just goes off the rails, what do you have that the rest of the world doesn't? You have assurance of eternal life with God. We have every reason to be the most optimistic people in a world that is full of pessimism, but we're not. We're just as pessimistic as everybody else. We are just as driven by misery as everybody else. And so as a result, we don't look at this as a time where the church can really prosper. And man, I think God's going to do something really great in his church. I think he's going to use his church to move in a powerful way at a time where people don't have anywhere else to turn. But instead, that's not how we think. We sit there and go, oh no, what's going to happen to attendance because of the virus? And what's going to happen? And how are we going to do this? And how are we going to do that? And how are we going to survive? And it's we have completely bought into the narrative that the world is selling that the sky is falling. Chicken Little Church of Christ. My nickname for Pam Jolly for many, many years, Chicken Little. Because Pam always tells me if something can go wrong, it will. By the way, if any of you have ever gotten an email from Pam and you wonder what WPF means, it means when pigs fly. And the reason it says that is she said she would get email when pigs fly. So when she got her email address, she put when pigs fly. That is what her, so now I've solved that mystery for all of you. Everybody now knows what, by the way, I didn't give the numbers at the end of it, so the rest of the world wouldn't have your email address, Pam. But that's what it means when pigs fly. And so we joke about that, but here's the question. Have you let the current circumstance of this world affect your witness in a positive way or a negative one? Have you become just another pessimistic voice that doesn't see anything good in the world? The whole thing's coming off the rails. Everything is terrible. Nothing's going to get better. This is going to be... I heard somebody the other day, me and Stephanie were Christmas shopping during our anniversary. We went up to Norfolk with Christmas shopping. And I heard somebody say, it's going to be the worst Christmas ever. I wonder how many of us know people who think that. This is, you know, supply chain issues and travel problems. And it's just going to be a terrible holiday season. And my reaction to that is, I'm sorry, is it not still Jesus' birthday? Is he still not on the throne? Is he still not the king? Is he still not the Messiah? Do we not still receive redemption and salvation through his name? What is going to affect, you know what's going to make this Christmas better or worse than any other one you've ever had? You. You and your attitude alone will dictate how positive this season is, because the truth of Jesus and his birth is totally unchanged. Politics doesn't change it. The supply chain doesn't change it. Coronavirus doesn't change it. Nothing changes the reality of this season except our attitude about it. And so we look back to Ahaz, surrounded by his enemies, and Isaiah comes in and says, here's what's going to happen. It's going to be bad for a while, but it's going to get better. It's going to get better. And this is going to be a sign to you. It's going to get better. I want to close this morning with some words that may be very familiar to you. And this will be a sign to you that you will find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes and lying in a manger. You remember that phrase? This is going to be a sign to you. A sign of what? It's going to be a sign of an entirely new existence. A new covenant. Everything changes because of this. This morning, I want, as the praise team comes to lead us in our communion song, I want to remind you that there may be challenges and difficulties for us personally, professionally, nationally, culturally, racially, whatever definition or definer you want to use, there may be difficulties for us in the years to come. I can't tell you that that is not a possibility. But I can tell you this, whatever happens, God is still on his throne. And he still speaks to his people if his people will listen. He speaks through his word. And there are plenty of Psalms that talk about, you know, David as he was in struggle and in misery and how he cried out to God. There are plenty of examples of how Paul and Peter and James and John dealt with difficulty during their lives as apostles. We even see Jesus, how he dealt with difficulty as he walked this earth. God speaks to us through that so that we have hope in the darkest of times. Guys, this isn't the darkest of times. It's difficult. It's challenging. But people who lived through the Great Depression will tell you this is not the darkest of times. People who lived through the 60s will tell you it's probably not the darkest of times. If we could go far enough back in history, people who lived through the bubonic plague, people who lived through world wars, famines, everything. They'll tell you, it's hard right now, but this is not the darkest of times. Let us use this opportunity to be positive, to share our faith and our hope in God despite the things that are going on around us.